A remarkable man with a remarkable story. Dr. Bernd Waschlager has written more than 100 articles and published a book, an autobiography about his life, A German Life Against All Odds, Change is Possible, in which he describes, and he'll describe to us this evening, growing up in Germany in the shadow of his father, who was a highly decorated World War II German tank commander who received a medal from Adolf Hitler himself. Our guest speaker is converted to Judaism, immigrated to Israel, now lives here in South Florida, is in private practice in Miami. His story is remarkable, his story is an inspiration, his story gives us faith in humanity's ability to discern right from wrong, good from evil, and to commit ourselves to bring goodness and light into the world. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Bernd Waschlager.
Thank you very much. Need to get the acoustic. Can everybody hear me? Okay, that's the most important part. Thank you very much for the invitation, Rabbi Goldberg, and thank you very much, Rabbi Moscovich. It's a great honor for me to be here, but still not very usual to do that, because I'm not standing here as the son of a survivor, but as the son of a perpetrator. On the one hand, I'm a proud Jew, I'm an Israeli citizen, served in the IDF, but on the other hand, I'm my father's son. And my father was one of those who had blood on his hands. And so for me, there are two hearts in my chest beating tonight when I'm attending an event, on the one hand, commemorating the loss, on the other hand, asking myself how it could happen, and how could have people like my father participated in such an event? How could it happen in the first place? And by telling my story, I hopefully can change some people's mind to understand that history is made by people. I don't believe that history is made by evil and goodness, but by people that can act either in the most humane and best way that human beings can behave as good people, and those who have chosen the path of evil. We can change history. We are the ones who make history. And so when I tell you my story, I have to tell you where I'm, first of all, where it all started. It started in 1958, when I was born in Bamberg, Germany, a beautiful town in the south of Germany, a town that is probably one of those picture book towns in, that you see in German tourist brochures. Beautiful houses, a thousand-year-old town with great history, the center of the Holy Roman Empire, characterized by churches from the 11th century, a cathedral in town, full of history. And in this town, it is literally in this museum, in this living, breathing museum I was born into, in a time when for me history was all what was in the past. And when I was growing up as a child, I learned that history was comprised of famous kings and queens and princes and the battles of the past, the glory of German history. But one thing I noticed as a child very early on, that the adults would not talk about certain parts of the recent past. There was a dark hole. There were no answers. And something I knew, I sensed happened, even when I was 6, 7, 8 years old, I knew that something happened, but nobody wanted to talk about. For example, there were 15,000 American soldiers and family members stationed outside the city, part of the fabric of the of Bamberg society of 75,000 people, so a very strong presence and visible presence, so something happened. And as a child, I knew a war happened, but obviously we lost that war. That's all what I knew. I also knew that my father and my mother, their life was shaped by that war, but they didn't want to talk about it. And when they slowly started to talk about the war, I heard two different stories. On the one hand, my father, on long walks that he had took with me on in the forest, he was an outdoor person, liked to hunt and fish, taught me how to handle a rifle, how to shoot. He had a very close relationship with me. I loved him, I adored him, I looked up to him. And he told me stories about his life as a tank commander in that war, the so-called Second World War, in which he served as the youngest tank commander of the German army, as one of the Blitzkrieger, disciples of the of General Guderian, the father of the Lightning War, and accomplished in that war, as he said, so much that he was awarded the Knight's Cross by a man whom he looked up to as his Führer and still adored as his Führer, Adolf Hitler. And for me, hearing this story as a naive 7-8 year old child, this was an example that my father was obviously a hero, a man that I should look up to, just not only because he was my father, but because he was a hero. And this message reinforced by his old war buddies who came to visit our house at least once a year to celebrate, as they said, the best time of their life, the good time, the war. On the other hand, my mother told me different stories. The story of loss, of horror, of catastrophe. That she lost everything in the war. She grew up as an ethnic German, and as a Sudeten German in Czechoslovakia and the western edges of Czechoslovakia. And for several generations, her family lived there, born in the city of Karlsbad. And she lost everything as the result of the war, had to flee from the advancing Soviet forces towards the west, losing their flourishing merchant business, their glove manufacturing factory, and their beautiful villa, and fleeing. The war is horror. The war is catastrophe. So these different pictures were painted in my mind. And there was something else that had to do with the house that I was living in and I grew up in. A massive two-story building, a patrician-style building. And in the entire second floor of this house, one lady lived there that I was not supposed to talk to. My mother told me she's a countess, eine Gräfin, as she said in German, and that I should only talk to her when I was talked to, respectfully referring to her as a noble woman. And in the hallway of this house was a larger-than-life portrait of a man hanging on the wall who looked like my father, a painting, in uniform, like I saw pictures of my father at home, with the uniform and the officer's insignia, the cross around his neck. And when I asked my father who this man was, my father referred to him as a traitor. And as a child, I knew that traitor is a bad word. But I couldn't understand how a man who looked like my father was bad, and a man, my father, in uniform was good. Later I learned that this man, whom my father referred to as a traitor, was a painting of Count Klaus von Stauffenberg, the German colonel, who was leading the assassination attempt on Adolf Hitler on the 20th of July 1944, which failed, and he was executed with thousands of others following the year after. His widow, Nina von Stauffenberg, lived upstairs. That was one of the reasons I was not supposed to talk to her. She was shunned. And later I learned from this woman, from Nina von Stauffenberg, that there was a different event in that time that my father didn't want to talk about. Something else happened. And what happened came to the surface in the summer of 1972, when I was 14 years old, which changed my life to the point that I'm standing here. This event called the Olympics in Munich, in München of 1972, which was supposedly should demonstrate to the world at that point in time that Germany is a different country, and it was a different country. It was not the Germany of 1936, the Olympics in Berlin that Hitler abused for propaganda purposes. This was the Germany of 1972, a democratic Germany led by a democratically elected government. First time in 1969, a chancellor, a prime minister was elected who himself was a victim of the Nazis. His name was Willy Brandt, who escaped Germany in 1933 from certain death because he was a social democrat and returned to Germany after the war, rebuilding his party. He was the first post-war German chancellor politician who traveled to Poland, to Warsaw, and in front of the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial, he sank on his knees, bowed his head, and asked for forgiveness, demonstrating in public that it is time to atone for sins, that Germany had to live up for his historic responsibility, not for the glory of his past, but for the crimes that he committed. And I remember this day in the December of 1970 because my father slammed the newspaper with a picture of the chancellor kneeling in front of the memorial on the breakfast table and screamed, Verrat, treason, because there was nothing to forgive for my father. And this same chancellor, with his tremendous moral standing in the Western world, opened the Olympics to a great fanfare, all the teams parading to the stadium. One of the teams parading to the stadium carried a flag with a star inside. And at that moment, nobody in the room, be watching TV at home with the family and friends, nobody in the room talked, as if a ghost appeared on the screen. And I knew that this is a team that belonged to a country called Israel. I learned it in school. Like Sweden, Switzerland, or France, a flag that belonged to a country had no understanding about the meaning, the implication, and I didn't understand why the adults wouldn't talk. And 10 days later, the catastrophe happened. The same team that so proudly paraded into the stadium was brutally attacked by a group of Palestinian terrorists. The peace of the Olympic Games was shattered. Two Israelis were murdered on the spot in the Olympic Village. The remainder taken hostage. The German government begging the Olympic Committee to interrupt the Games, which they reluctantly did. And German government officials, among them the Minister of Interior Affairs, negotiated face-to-face with the terrorist leader, begging him to release the hostages, offering himself as a hostage. And it was refused. A deal was struck to fly out the terrorists with the hostages to a military airport outside Munich called Fürstenfeldbruck, where allegedly a plane would wait to fly out the hostages with the terrorists to a military airport in an Arab country of their choice, where an exchange of the hostages with Arab prisoners from Israeli prisons would take place. It never happened. The German police opened fire. In a firefight, all Israelis died. The terrorists threw a hand grenade in one of the helicopters where the Israelis were tied and bound to the chairs, and it exploded, killed him instantly. And the other helicopter they sprayed with machine gun fire, and all the Israeli hostages, unable to escape, were killed. And the next day, this picture in the newspaper that changed me. A helicopter on the tarmac, one burned out with the charred remains of people inside, the other with the bodies with the Israeli slumped of the chairs, and a big headline above, Jews killed in Germany again. And I asked myself the question, what does that mean? And I asked, whom could I ask? I asked my father. And I specifically asked my father for guidance. And in this moment, I asked him for guidance too. I said, Father, what does it mean? And my father looked at me with cold eyes and said, it means nothing. It's over with them. We're done with them. We dealt with them. In our house, we don't talk about them. Them, he meant the Jews. And I was stunned because this was not my father. He normally engaged me in very animated and agitated discussions. He was an intelligent man. Why he wouldn't talk about that? And in school, our teacher started to talk about the past as it pertained to the event in Munich, the murder of Jews on German soil, why we as first generation should understand what it meant. And when I heard for the first time the words Auschwitz and Birkenau, the final solution, Eichmann, Mengele, the mass murder of an entire people, not as a result of war as we learned before, but as a result of hatred, of genocide, of mass murder, I was stunned. I was shocked. And I asked myself a single question. What did my father do? The man, the hero, who fought on every front from the 1st of September 1939 in Poland throughout the entire war until April 1945 when he was captured by American troops at the border to France. A fanatic warrior. What did he do? And I asked him. I said, Father, in school we learned about the Holocaust. What did you know about that? And my father looked at me and said, it's all a lie. Your teachers are communists. It's all propaganda. It never happened. And I knew at that moment that something is very, very wrong. Should I believe my father or should I believe somebody else, my teachers? And I read as much as I could about the past from books that I found. And the more I read, the more desperate I became to understand what my father did. And I used his weakness. He was a raging alcoholic. To find the opportunity when he was softened up by alcohol to ask him questions. And the answers came out in phases. Phase one, yes, something happened, but we didn't do it. It was the SS. The SS did that. We fought a clean war, which was a lie. The Wehrmacht fought the war against the Jews by orders of the Führer, whom everybody swore an oath to. And it was so bad that ranking German officers complained to Adolf Hitler that the murder of civilians erodes and corrodes morale. Of course it did. So my father lied. The second phase of answers were characterized by the description, these were partisans, and we had to fight a war, and those partisans that were bearing weapons we had to kill. And I said, that cannot be true, because I learned at that point in time that Auschwitz included the murder of 1.2 million children, innocent lives. How could they fight against you? I asked him rhetorically. It doesn't make sense. Cannot be true. And then came the final phase, which was characterized by the fact that he admitted. And he said, Bernd, and he set me down as if he wanted to have a serious discussion with me. He said, Bernd, you have to understand, it had to happen because it was our historic responsibility as Germans to clean up the riffraff of the past that the generations before us left behind. And we had the historic responsibility to clean up. So we had to do what we had to do. And I asked him, murder? He said, this was not murder. It was a historic solution. The only mistake that we made, that we used the train capacity to transport them, he never used the term Jews, to transport them to the camps, that we had not this train capacity available to supply the troops in the front with weapons, therefore we lost the war. The Jews made us lose the war. It was a sickening, revolting argument, which I unfortunately heard before from other deniers. And I actually heard the truth from Stauffenberg's widow, that her husband found out about Auschwitz in 1942 and turned and joined the resistance as a colonel. And that this was a known fact among all officers what happened. Everybody knew. Just some acted and some didn't. And my father was one of them who knew. And the worst of it, later, many years later, I found a picture, him sitting together with Heinrich Himmler, with another two ranking officers, chit-chatting in the summer of 1942 in Russia, in a meeting. Which obviously negated the fact that he lied to me, or proved the fact that he lied to me, negated the fact that German officers had nothing to do with the SS. Yes, they collaborated very closely. And I turned away from this. This was the straw that broke the camel's neck back. And I turned away from my father. I could not look up to him as the man who could provide me values. I could not look up to him as the man I could love. I turned away and I was looking for answers. And one of my teachers set me down one day, who noticed my desperation. He was a Jesuit priest, former Jesuit priest, and I was born and raised Catholic. And he said, Bernd, I understand your struggle, but the only way that you can resolve the struggle is to make amends. And the amends you can make to those who suffered. And I said, I don't know those who suffered. I never met a Jew in my life. The only thing that I heard about Jews was that the Jews killed Jesus, allegedly. That's what I heard in Catholic school. That's the only thing I knew about Jews. I didn't believe it, but that's what I knew. So he put me together with a group of young Israelis, Jews and Arabs alike, who came to Germany in the fall of 1977 on a peace mission invited by the German government, sponsored by the German government. And I met for the first time, participating in this meeting, Jews. And of course, we are alike. There is no difference between me and them. We were alike. We were young people. And I struck a deep friendship with some of them, especially one girl. I have to admit, it was not all spiritually motivated. I'm in the presence of rabbis. I have to be truthful. As a result of this meeting, I was enthralled by the fact that we were alike. And she asked me, why don't you visit me in Israel? And of course, as a big Schwitzer, I said, absolutely, I do that. And not only wanted I see her again, but I wanted to meet those people. They were unique because they were so alike me. And so, without having any money in the summer of 1978, I traveled, hitchhiked to Italy, because no other way to do that, and took a ferry from there, from the port city of Ancona, shipping throughout the entire Mediterranean. I do not recommend it, it's not a cruise. And arrived in Haifa, where she received me enthusiastically, and sent a telex before. This was the time before Google Schmuggle, things we didn't have that. And she brought me to her parents' apartment, which was a small apartment in Neve Shanan in Haifa. And her father and mother, lovely Eastern European family, brought me into the house, took away my rucksack, set it in a room where they said, you have to stay here, spoke Yiddish, I didn't understand a word, set me down on the table, brought out the food, and started to talk. And her father noticed that I had a hard time following. And so he stood up, he stepped back and looked at me as if he was thinking, and said, look, Bernd, in German, if you want, we can speak German. And I asked him, how did you learn German, already knowing the answer? And he said nothing. He just rolled up the sleeve on his forearm, pointed with a number to the number tattooed on his arm, and said in German, ich war in den Lagern, I was in the camps. And I wanted to disappear in the ground because I was so ashamed. And he said, don't worry about it. You didn't do that. Maybe your father did. But you need to understand, you have the responsibility to understand what we went through. And I want to teach you. And even though he was a laborer in the port of Haifa, a strong man, a forework in the port of Haifa, foreman in the port of Haifa, he took the time a day off and took me to Yad Vashem. and showed me Yad Vashem together with his wife and his daughter, introducing me to the fact of the Shoah, not the Holocaust, which is a horrible word, by the way, because Holocaust is Holocaustus, the burnt offering, as if a religious ceremony took place in Auschwitz-Birkenau. At the Dante's Inferno, the gates to hell, no religious ceremony took place, it was mass murder. Therefore the Hebrew term to Shoah accurately describes what trying to describe what happened. And it dawned on me the enormity of this mass murder, the enormity of the number, that 6 million is not only a number, but it's an aggregate of 1 plus 1 plus 1. Every person a fate, every person had a history, every person had a family. And I was so deeply ashamed and shocked. And I also asked myself, how can those people who suffered so much can look forward to the future, build not only a country, but build families and stick to their faith? They have all the right to turn away. There is something unique among the Jews that I need to understand, because I don't understand how they can maintain their optimism. So on my way back to Germany, I pondered the question how I can find about Jews. And I took the courage to look up a Jewish community in my hometown, a small Jewish community left in my hometown, Bamberg, remnants of a 1,000-year-old Jewish community in that area, who had a small kehile, as they called it, in a Gebetsstube, Stibbelich, in one of the apartments in downtown Bamberg. And the chair of the Jewish community whom I approached, his name was Itzhak Rosenberg, who reluctantly let me in for the first meeting in the room that they called a Gebetsstibbelich. He introduced me to the Jewish life in Bamberg. And when he noticed my interest and my insistence that I wanted to learn, he said, "Look, I normally don't deal with Germans, but if you want to learn about Jews, I can make a geschäft. You will be my Shabbos goy, and on return, I teach you about what you want to know." And I said, I didn't know what a Shabbos goy was. I took the job, of course, because that was my ticket in. And I became a Shabbos goy in this community of about 30 Holocaust survivors. All were those left in Germany after the war, from Poland. None of them were originally born in Germany. All had a number tattooed on their forearm. All of them looked at me very suspiciously because I was the intruder in this small world that they carved out for themselves. And in this community, I literally grew into as a family of my choice. Every Friday and Saturday, I went there. Every holiday, month by month, year by year. And became a fixture in this community, coming closer and closer to this community. The closer I became, the more detached I became from my family of origin. And it came, of course, there were conflicts. My father found out. And clearly asked me why I'm doing this. And I couldn't answer him. I didn't have the strength and the power to answer him. I said, I do what I want to do. But then it came a day, actually. It was Christmas, a very holy day in our house. My mother was a devout Catholic, where I had to be at home to celebrate Christmas and going to Mass with my mother, and I was not there because it was Friday night. And I can play this movie of Christmas in my mind. Going to Mass, having the dinner with my family with symbolic food, lentil soup and carb, going into the living room with a real Christmas tree with candles, my father standing next to it in his finest dark suit with a knight's cross around his neck, celebrating Christmas by singing festive Christmas hymns. And I was not there. Next day I came back, and all hell broke loose, and my father confronted me and yelled, and my mother was crying, and demanded an answer, and I said, "Let's stop this Greek tragedy." I was in temple, where I'm going regularly, and I tell you honestly, I don't want to sit with a man who has this cross around his neck, blood-stained cross around his neck, pretending to celebrate Christmas, a murderer with the blood on his hands. I will not sit at the same table with you anymore. And he said, "Kein Problem, no problem, raus, get out." Now there was a problem, I was cut off. And the only connection that I had was my family of choice, the Jewish community. And they took pity on me because they found out what happened and took me under the wings and helped me to finish my medical studies. And I became their Benjamin. And one of the members of this Jewish community was a Holocaust survivor himself. He died. Who was very close, became very close, he died, and asked the chair of the community before his death that I be part of the Chevra Kadisha, which I, of course, knew I could not be as a non-Jew. And I told Itzhak that. And Itzhak told me, "We decided that you're one of us. and you have to give us the honor. We know that you're not a Jew, but you're one of us. And when I was standing at the graveside and everybody saying Kaddish, I said, I'm one of them. Then I have to be one of them. I want to be one of them. This is my family. And I asked Yitzhak, I said, Yitzhak, I want to become a Jew. And Yitzhak told me, rolled up the sleeve of his forearm, said, if you want that suffering, that's what you get. There is no worthwhile effort to undertake to become a Jew. Don't do it. And he rejected me, of course. He said, but I know a rabbi, it was at Chochmah, I know a rabbi in Frankfurt, he knows how to talk you out of it. And he sent me to a rabbi in Frankfurt, and the rabbi in Frankfurt, a very polite man, took me under his wings, and he said, I will teach you anything you want to know out of respect for my friend Yitzhak, but I will not convert Germans, never. And after about 2 years working with him, this was already in the seventh year of my spiritual journey, he finally relented and said, I will refer my case to the rabbinical court where every cards are on the table, it will be open. They may approve or not approve of my request, but until I get there, I have to take irrevocable steps, we don't have to go into the details, that involve a plastic surgery that doesn't involve the nose. And it had to be done kosher in an Orthodox mohel in Switzerland, which I did. And then a few months later, I did an Orthodox mikveh in Metz in France. And then my case was presented. I presented my case to the rabbinical court in October 1986, in the seventh year. And I'll never forget this date, because I was sitting where the good rabbi sat, in front of a rabbi who was sitting on the podium. Had to face them and answer question about my knowledge of Judaism, which I thought this was sufficient. And they listened very politely and then asked me a simple question. I said, why does a German want to become a Jew? Is it guilt, Schande, that doesn't count? Is it conviction, then knowledge doesn't supplant conviction? Conviction comes from the heart. You need to convince us. And so I convinced them, because when they retreated and came back, and after the Dion, I had to stand up and they read to me in my conversion certificate in Hebrew and then in German, which I still have, of course, and became a Jew, which for me was, I was in heaven. This was for me where I wanted to be. And coming back to Bamberg, I shared with Yitzhak, said, Yitzhak, I'm a Jew now and I want to leave. They said, where you want to go? I said, I'm going to Israel, because it's the only place I can go to. And he was very disappointed, of course, but he helped me to get recognized to the Israeli embassy and the Sukhnut, the Jewish agency in Frankfurt. Within 2 months, I had according to the law of return, a visa stamped in my passport, and got a date, 7th of January 1987, for the day of Aliyah to Israel. And I was dead bent set to leave without saying goodbye to everybody, except my friend Yitzhak and my friends in the Jewish community. And a few days before, I visited him, and it was a very somber meeting, but Yitzhak wanted to know, and he said, Bernd, I wanted to know, we talk about the mitzvahs and the commandments, I don't know if you can live them. Can you do that? It's because it's a real burden. I said, Yitzhak, I will try. But I said, then let me test you. You can prove it right now. Do you honor your parents? I said, Yitzhak, I can't do that. I said, then you're not a Jew. I said, Yitzhak, what do you want to do? Because I had a meaning as a man, I looked up to you. It was my quasi-father. I said, you have to say goodbye to your parents regardless what it means, regardless how revolted you are. You have to do it because as a Jew, you made a commitment. And I went home last night. I said goodbye to my mother. My father refused seeing me. He screamed and yelled, I should get the hell out of the house. And the next day, I left for Israel and began my journey, as we call it, the Aliyah, the Klita. Came to a kibbutz, 6 months, worked, no money, so I had to work during the day, learn Hebrew in the night. Did a year in the hospital to get my license up to Israeli part, and was drafted, of course, because I became immediately an Israeli citizen, was drafted into the military. Because I was a doctor, I had to become an officer and had to do the officer's course, and suddenly I found myself in the moment of clarity, standing in front of a unit where I was assigned to as a physician in the combat unit, together with the commanding officer. And I was standing there with the uniform of a lieutenant in the Israeli army, and I said, I'm in deep trouble. I'm in deep, deep trouble. Because if they find out who I am, that I'm my father's son, that my father was a Nazi officer, they will not respect me. Worse, I don't know what will happen. And I was petrified. And I didn't tell anybody. They only knew that I'm from Germany, I was born in Germany, I was a Jew, and I made Aliyah. It was all correct, but the minor details or major details are left out, which caused me a lot of troubles. Bitachon Sadeh, military security, of course, they found it very peculiar that I was leaving out certain parts of my life. That's not that you don't do that. And I didn't talk even to my wife, the closest confidant, I didn't talk with her about that. I lied. And when we came to the United States in the summer of 1991 to continue my postgraduate training in here, my son became to an age, he was 14, and he asked me, his name is Tal, he asked me a simple question, which forced me to answer. Because until this time, nobody knew, only knew that I was born in Germany and that's all. He asked me, Abba, mi es Abba Shili? Father, who is my grandfather? And I looked at him and I knew if I lie to him, that's it. I break a trust. And I said, that's it, I will tell him. And I told him the story, and his reaction, it was like a 14-year-old. It's a cool story, Dad. And he was so enthralled by the story that in the school, the Hillel, he once goes to Hillel, I don't make advertising for it, but he went to Hillel in North Miami Beach, where my children went to school, and they had a family history day, and everybody shared their family history, and it was reported to me that during the family history day, he raised his hand and said that my grandfather was a famous Nazi. Now, if you do that in a Jewish school, you're in a big trouble. And I got the call from the principal's office. I had to go there, and the principal was very upset. I thought my son lost his marbles. And he asked me, how can we help him? And I said, there's nothing wrong with my son. He's a good boy. He just shared what his father told him. And it's the truth. And I didn't know what's going to happen. It would kick me out, kick him out. The rabbi who was present through the conversation got more and more agitated in the positive sense and said, this is a wonderful story, Yeshua Koach, you need to share it. I said, I can't, I don't have the strength. I said, you need to, because there's a meaning. And so I shared it for the first time reluctantly to my son's class and then to another class. And what happened is that a weight was lifted off my shoulders, and I asked myself a simple question, why did I never close the circle of life that I opened for so many years ago? I have to close it. I have to move on by closing a chapter and opening a new chapter. I have to go back. And I did, with my son and my family. We went back to Germany and visited my parents' grave, because they were dead, of course. Actually, I knew that they died, because I received a letter from court that I was taken out of the will, and that a specific wish of my father that I should never approach his grave and should not pay homage to him. And I did, of course, because this is what I had to do. And ironically or tellingly, which even today you can find, my parents' grave is about 3 rows to 4 rows parallel to the wall, literally a stone throw from the wall that separates the Christian from the Jewish cemetery. Not unusual in old cities like in Bamberg in Germany. When you look towards that wall, you see on the other side the tall Jewish gravestones of 19th century Jews that built and have a proud temple on top of their grave, casting their shadow almost defiantly to the other side. And I asked myself and told my son, this is the irony of history, that my parents still live in the shadow of history, your grandparents, because they never had the guts to face history, so you're condemned to live in the shadow. You cannot escape history. You have to face it, and you have to face it in the good and the bad and the ugly. And I had to face it, and I had to make my decisions, and I stepped out in the light to step out of the shadow to face the reality. And that's what you have to do by living a life. Live it honestly and live it truthfully. And most importantly, understand why it happened. Why it happened that a man like my father, who was not evil, who was a man whom I loved and adored and respected because I only had one father, became a man with such a different face and did what he did. Because it all started out with a word. The words of hatred that planted seeds in the human minds. From these plants of these seeds sprout out deeds. And these deeds formed habits. Habits of hateful action. Beating Jews. Killing Jews. And then from there character formed. And this character was accepted in society. Social norms developed. And that explains that places like Auschwitz could thrive. and the world of hatred. It didn't happen overnight. It was a process that always starts with a word. And therefore, if I hope that I can impart on you that the way to respond to the horrors of Auschwitz and Birkenau and Majdanek and Treblinka and all the other unnamed and named mass places of mass murders and the unnamed graves of so many more victims, that it all started with words of hatred. And we can make a difference as individuals to counter that hatred by not allowing the words of hatred to be spread in the world, either interpersonally when we encounter that, or as the good rabbi just told us about, from other people from other countries who use these words until today. We have to speak up loud and clearly, not only as Jews, but as humans on this planet Earth. Specifically as Jews because of the suffering, but as humans who respond to that because it happened over and over again, from Cambodia in 1974 where 2 million Cambodians died, to Rwanda in 1991, in the early 90s where 800,000 Rwandans were slaughtered, to the center of Europe, Bosnia and Serbia, where Muslims were slaughtered and herded into concentration camps. We as human beings have to speak up. And let's take such a day as a remembrance, as an eternal remembrance, that we can make a difference by living a different life, by speaking up, and hopefully my life made a difference and will make a difference to you. Thank you.
On behalf of us all, I want to thank Dr. Walschlager. I want to thank Dr. Walschlager for undoubtedly the courage it takes each time you tell that story to open yourself up. It's truly an inspiration. Thank you so much for being with us this evening. The doctor's books are actually available for sale immediately following, momentarily, so you can feel free to read more about this remarkable story in the book. This time we ask everyone to please rise. So we call on Daniel Adler to lead us in the singing of Hatikvah.